Before we start today, I just want to speak on behalf of myself and Josh, and I want to say how saddened we were to learn of the passing of Angels pitcher Tyler Skaggs. We're baseball fans. We live in a baseball world. You know, the Major League Baseball is part of our world, and we like to think that we're part of their world as fans. So when somebody who's 27 years old all of a sudden loses their life for some unexplained reason, and it saddens us as fans, and it affects us. But we're not going to sit here and say that it affects us as much as it affects Tyler's Angels teammates and Tyler's family and friends. So we just want to say that we sit here and we grieve for you, and we're saddened by the loss of Tyler Skaggs, as I'm sure the Angels are, and the Angels have been dealing with this way too much in their history and way too much over the last 10 years. So we're thinking of you at this moment, and we grieve for you and we're saddened for you. That being said, we want to welcome you to the Burger Ball podcast, and thank you for joining us today, and thank you for listening to us. And Josh, thank you for coming and hanging out with me.
Thank you. I have such a deep and even growing appreciation and admiration for you as I get older.
Now, easy.
Wait. Let me finish. This year in particular, I have noticed a certain tenacity within your soul to thrive, not just thrive, but excel. Blogging, if not consistently, but persistently and relastically on MetsTradamusBlog.com each and every day, even as the Mets continue to spiral into the deep abyss of baseball hell. And it's with that tenacity that it empowers me to want to be part of this even more, to learn what fuels you, what fires you, and what drives you to this point of contempt.
I don't think it's any great secret with the contempt that lies within me, but it's really, we're here, I think, today, and I wanted to focus on this more, the contempt that the Mets seem to have for their fans. I want to focus more on game day experience today, because look, we're all, we know what's happening with the team on the field. We know what's happening with the team in the boardroom, in the front office. We can talk ad hoc about the Edwin Diaz trade, how much of a disaster that's turned out to be. And I think it's all intertwined for sure. But here's the problem that I've noticed this year in particular. Now, you look at the Mets the last 3 years post playoffs, their last playoff game coming in 2016, which I was at and I suffered through. But, enough about that. 2017, the Mets finished the first half of the season at the All-Star break with 39 wins. 2018, also 39 wins. This year, 40 wins and the second worst record in the National League ahead of the Miami Marlins, which all in itself is abominable. I will throw in, listen, I know people are probably thinking, oh, why don't you talk about Pete Alonso and the home run derby? Pete Alonso winning the home run derby was awesome. I hope everybody had fun. Guerrero Jr. was great. Jock Peterson was great. Alonso won. He won fair and square. It's a fun event, and I'm happy for Alonso, and I'm happy that the Mets are trying to take advantage of this by offering 80% discounts on tickets, and this is true. Look it up. But I want to talk more. Again, I've noticed something this year. There's something different about this season as opposed to the last two. This season, I've noticed more and more in talking with people and seeing tweets that they go along the lines of, I'm apathetic towards the Mets this year. I haven't been to a game yet. I don't watch as many games as I used to. Now, usually when the Mets have a bad first half, it produces a lot of anger. And it does. It did that this year, but the apathetic portion of it is distressing. And I think it should distress the ownership of this team, but it won't. So I asked myself, why this year? why of all years, 9 out of 11 years, this team has been bad.
Yes.
But this year, it's finally starting to wear on people. And I don't think it's just the on-field product that's affecting this. I really believe that the game day experience has taken a hit this year. I think that it's different this year. I think that the Mets are making things difficult for their fans with the game day experience. I touched on it a little bit the last time in terms of the Uber rides, how they make this grand proclamation that Uber is the official rideshare partner of the Mets. Yet when you leave Citi Field after a game to head to the center field exit, open gate exit, where they have signs for the Uber pickup, the Citi Field ushers will turn you away and say, no, you have to leave this way and go all the way around. An unnecessary way to make things difficult for your fans. It's unnecessary. And then you wait for the Ubers, and then the real Ubers come and the cops chase them away because they're blocking the street. But the fake Uber drivers that are on the sidewalk saying, hey, ride with me, I'm Uber, but they upcharge for $20, $30 for a ride home, that they do nothing about. Another thing that makes things difficult for the fans. And then how about the backpack rule, the no backpack rule, which is nobody has any common sense about, because backpacks that seven-year-old kids are going to the ballpark with are being confiscated. Backpack purses that can barely hold anything more than a juice box are being confiscated, making things difficult for the fans. You go online for a food item and, oh, right next door they have Dasani waters, which, by the way, are $5.75, which is ridiculous because Coca-Cola has a big sign in right field sponsoring the stadium. They should not be that expensive, but be that as it may. Dasani waters are right next door, yet the person manning that stand will not go over to the next stand and grab a Dasani and ring it up for you. No, you got to wait on that line too. So you got to wait on two separate lines if you want a particular food item and a Dasani water, making things difficult for the fan, the customer. And I think that, among other things, it's wearing on people. The ballpark experience, if you're going to come to watch a bad team, at least they should be able to enjoy the process of watching a ball game. Another case in point, they had a ceremony for the 1969 Mets at 3 o'clock. Be in your seats at 3 o'clock, they all told us. And yet they didn't open the gates any earlier. They opened gates 2 hours before game time. If you're supposed to be in your seats at 3 o'clock for a ceremony, the gates should open 2 hours before that. There were still lines of people looking to get into the park at 2:45. So from that, the ceremony had to be delayed, which it was, making the day even longer. Baseball games are long enough, and that game had a rain delay. That game didn't end until 9 o'clock at night. That's a long day. That's a seven-hour day to go to a ball game. I know you can't do anything about the rain delay, but you could do something about the fan experience. That day would have been a lot less long had it not been for that snafu, not opening the gates earlier. Okay? So it's just things like that, that, and now you combine it with things like with Page Click Martino writing articles about why we should appreciate Chase Utley. Why do you hate us? Why do you hate us, the Mets fan? I've never known an ownership of a baseball team to have more contempt for their fan base as the Mets do to us. Now, I want to lead into your thoughts, Josh, with this. I want to say that the apathy is dangerous, but I think it's more dangerous for your generation. You're much younger than me. Because fans that are my age, I'm pushing 50 here, we grew up in an era where you were loyal to your team, and it really takes an act of God to switch to another team. I mean, for my feeling is that, okay, yeah, I might be more apathetic towards a Mets game. I might not get as crazy watching, but I'll still watch. And I'm not going to be a full-time fan of another team unless the Mets move or Citi Field gets blown up like in the Avengers movie. It's just not going to happen. But the younger generation that's trained to learn that baseball teams are businesses rather than competitive baseball teams, I think younger people, when they get apathetic, they're going to change from Mets to Phillies or from Mets to Braves or even Mets to Yankees, like you would change toothpaste brands if the toothpaste brand you're using doesn't work for you or anything else. That's the way I see it. I've had conversations with you about the way you're feeling. So I want to know, how dangerous is apathy to this team, this organization right now?
It's incredibly, incredibly dangerous. And I'm going to provide somewhat of a multi-tiered answer. And I look forward to this conversation. It's one I've been looking to have for a long time. And it's one that, quite frankly, I've been having a lot, both in digital spaces and in real life. And people don't seem to believe me. And when I say what I will end up saying here, and ultimately, I believe that life ultimately is short. And we don't know when things will ultimately end. We unfortunately had to open this episode recounting Tyler Skaggs' untimely death. And it's the second time in the last decade that the Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim underwent a tragedy for a player far too young to leave this earth. And unfortunately, we deal with a reality every day that we are guaranteed only this specific present moment and nothing else. And I believe, and many in my generation believe, that life is too short to focus on things that are overwhelmingly negative and bring you immense negativity. I mean, you see it in pop culture with Marie Kondo and her movement, in the sense that our generation and a lot of people think that if something does not bring you inherent pleasure, there's no point in suffering or being a martyr for a cause that doesn't particularly care about you. And I think that you have a lot of different sentiments toward the world in general because of that. And I don't even consider this a political issue, but when we consider that maybe if our own mortality is not necessarily at the forefront of our psyche or our everyday thoughts, then at the very least, we have to consider that irreversible climate change, according to the IPCC, is now 10 and a half years away. So if our own mortality won't get us, then perhaps a tsunami or a hurricane or earthquake or tornado or some other act of God will. And so with that in mind, I want to be able to both make a difference in the world, be an activist in spaces I can, and enjoy life to the fullest extent of my ability. And from 2009, when I became a full-time everyday New York Mets fan after going to games for the majority of my childhood, until 2016, I probably averaged anywhere between 15 to 20 games a year. And that includes missing my high school senior prom to pay $10 to join the dozens of other Mets fans that went to an Oakland A's New York Mets doubleheader. It was probably one of those John Neese, Dylan G starts. And you know, those were the things that inherently brought me joy. At least there was a semblance of a plan. At least there was something to buy into. At least there was an overarching Aristotelian narrative structure that I could believe that, hey, bear through a few years and what you're going to get is you're going to be able to reap the fruit of this effort, this struggle. And we got to see the growth of a team. We got to see players emerge like Michael Conforto in 2015, Jacob deGrom in 2014. We saw the trade that brought Noah Syndergaard and Travis d'Arnaud to New York, and we watched them come to the major leagues almost within a year of each other or 2 years of each other at the very least. And we got to see the emergence of growth, of narrative. And what began to make the fundamental shift for me in terms of my attitude toward the team was not even necessarily the game day experience. No, it was something else entirely. It was the contradictions that started to emerge within the organization. And I, of course, had been aware of some of Howard Medgill's reporting on the Wilpons. But it, at the time, it seemed super fringy. I don't even know if I was truly old enough to understand all the complexities of meddling in business and having a hands-on approach. But as time went on, you start to hear stories from people like Pedro Martinez, who said that Jelf Wilpon basically asserted his dominance and said, well, we're paying you. You're going to go out and you're going to pitch. He went out and pitched and essentially screwed up the rest of his career until a brief renaissance with the Phillies in 2008 and 9. And so when you start to see stories like that emerge, you say, okay, but – and you start to make excuses for the entity that, that has brought you so much pleasure and you've invested a lot of your own personal time, your own personal breath into. But then in 2016, I was thinking about this last night after you sent the outline. I wanted to pinpoint the moment that things changed for me. And for me, things began to change at the last playoff game you went to, John. And that game was the 2016 National League wild card. And it was Madison Bumgarner versus Noah Syndergaard. And the Mets were they were lucky to have gotten to that point. It was another magical run to even get to that playoff game. But they did something strange that didn't seem resonant with Alderson, with the organization, but maybe it was that year. And they started James Loney at first base. And it seems like a weird thing to say that one decision like that can fundamentally shift or serve as the platform for an entire lifestyle or baseball fandom shift. But it didn't make sense because both Kelly Johnson and Eric Campbell were clear better options. And that's coming from not even a certified sabermetrician, if such a thing exists, but someone that just blogged and podcasted, read and wrote about baseball, played recreationally and hosted a few fundraisers about it for it. And so that began to make the shift. In 2017 and 18, I started to feel the apathy. Things became a little bit too predictable. I had seen the cycle, essentially one full cycle of boom and bust. And then this year, things really started to change. More stuff came out about the Wilpons. And as we've discussed about in previous podcasts, and I do welcome the audience to go back and listen to the archive of the show, Brody Van Wagenen essentially was the Scooby-Doo cast and the villain, and when the cast takes off, when the main characters take off the mask of one of the villains, and it turns out to be another human, and he's essentially the epitome of everything that the Wilpons had an underlying tension over the years. It makes sense why Sandy Alderson was never able to be fully successful, and ultimately, I stopped having joy in general around the Mets. I realized, I looked back and I said, it's been 2 or 3 years since I've even wanted to turn on a game. Going to a game is a chore. For me to commute from Long Island, it's a $25 park to park my car, plus gas, plus traffic. It's a time and monetary investment. To go on the train, it's like an $18 or $15 round trip, something like that, with 2 or 3 transfers. Like you said, it's $5.75 for a bottle of water. You go to concession stands around the stadium. You miss 2 or 3 innings to get to, for the privilege to pay $5 or $6 to stay hydrated. I'm not even allowed to bring things into the stadium, as you mentioned. And so I realized that I was enjoying baseball more than the Mets, and everything around the Mets had a negativity associated with it. And I felt bad, and I felt fundamentally bad because here's this staple, here's this pillar of my life. And to be sure, it could have a lot to do with other interests in my life and grad school and going into more media and political spaces. But it wasn't really that, because I could watch any other baseball game or turn on MLB Network and still be as intrigued. So what is that? And after, you know, about a year, year and a half of debating, I finally said, F it. Until the Wilpons sell, I'm actually no longer a New York Mets fan. I struggled. I went to the New York Mets game against the Yankees last Thursday, and I didn't have fun. And I wasn't particularly looking forward to it. And I had fun with my friends and talking to them, but I don't remember the game at all. And I was there. It was helpless. It was hapless. It was punchless. And that's, I think, the danger. And I think that's what, and I think that's my confession here.
It's a lot to take in for sure. You've given us a lot of food for thought. And listen, some people might listen to that and they might be turning off this podcast at that point. They might have cast their dispersions on you and say, well, he's not a real Mets fan and yada, yada, yada. But there are a lot of real Mets fans that would never think of changing allegiances, but they're starting to feel that way. They're starting to feel that all they are pawns, okay? That they don't feel valued. And I say that as somebody who has a ticket plan and whose ticket representative is a very, very nice guy I've dealt with on many occasions, and he's always been good to me. But you know, also listen, let's face it, the ticket reps are there to try and sell you ticket plans. So it's not an altruistic relationship there. So but yeah, they're trying to get you in. But you know, for me, it's like, why am I dealing with a 20 game ticket plan when it's impossible to find other people that will take the tickets from you, that will buy the tickets from you, that you can even give the tickets away, because they don't want the hassle of going to Citi Field because of all these things that are happening and because the team is bad. And I know that, you know, I'll confess something to you right now is that I'm thinking of not renewing next year. It's not because the team is bad. I've renewed twice already with the team being bad. But that's a very small part of the equation for me. It's not that they're simply that they're bad, but it's because the cycle doesn't seem to be changing, like you said, with that team. You know, when the team was bad when I was young, when the team was bad after the Seaver trade in 78 and 79, you could trace it back. You could always trace it back to either the manager or the general manager, somebody that could be replaced. And you knew that in the changeover mentality of baseball, when that person is replaced, things will pick up. That all ownership has to do is hire the right people. And if they don't hire the right people, they will not have success. So if they hire the right people, like Frank Cashin, like Joe McElvain, like Bobby Valentine, when you hire those people, you know, even Omar and Sandy to an extent, they both had their flaws, but there were good things about them as well, that things would pick up. But when you trace the dysfunction back to ownership, that is not going to be replaced, that will not sell the team. When you trace the dysfunction back there, you throw up your hands and say, well, what do? Because now at this point, and I'm as guilty of this as anybody, although I try to suppress it, is that every Travis d'Arnaud throwing error, every Wilson Ramos throwing error, I don't mean to pick on the catchers, everything that the Mets do fundamentally wrong traces back to ownership. So you're like, oh, well, you know what? We're stuck with these owners, because ownership will not, it doesn't seem like they'll hire the right people. Yes, they employed Sandy Alderson, who did a very good job. He had his weaknesses. His last offseason was not a good one. But at least, like you said, there was a plan going forward. But the key is that Sandy Alderson was forced upon them by Major League Baseball. This wasn't necessarily a Wilpon hire. This guy we've got in now, Nate Lashley, Brody Von Monorail. Yes, and thanks, Josh, for coming up with that nickname. He's a Wilpon hire, and he was an agent. He's not even a baseball mind. He's a mind for money and marketing and all these things that may not have anything to do with baseball. Yeah, there's questions about the motives for him acquiring players. Is he acquiring players that worked for his agency? you know, cough, cough, Robinson Cano. and so there's questions about that. And it just seems there's a Twitter account, Mets Daddy. And I know he has some, you know, polarizing opinions about him sometimes, but he came up with an interesting question on Twitter. He said, "Is this the angriest you've been as a Met fan?" And I don't know if angry is the right word. And that's the problem, because when you're angry about something, you're passionate about it. I think for me, I've never felt more hopeless as a Mets fan. And then and that's the problem. And then when you combine it with the game day experience, which I feel has really taken a hit this year, that's a big problem.
Now I'm going to have to jump in here and ask another question. And it's definitely ownership, right? But it's also something else. Why is it that it appears that the Mets can go out and acquire superstar players or above average players? And every time, if not every time, 80 to 90% of the time, these players come here and get worse. While underperforming players with the Mets, who you understand have potential, go elsewhere and achieve that potential. And right now, you see these decisions being made that stifle the team, both short-term and long-term decisions that are made with absolute no coherency. And I'm going to circle back, and perhaps this is even the last time we talk about him on this show. But, you know, for the last 6 years, we've been discussing Travis d'Arnaud.
We're never going to stop discussing Travis d'Arnaud, ever. I'm going to just jump in before you start. Guy is hitting like 300 in his last 25 games. He's batting leadoff and playing first base for Tampa Bay. So
that's exactly the point. Why are you signing a catcher who, by the way, would probably be better received than Wilson Ramos at this point? And he goes to Tampa. He's given a chance to get back. And by the way, there was a quote in that New York Post article that where they interviewed d'Arnaud about what it's been like to transition from New York to Tampa. And he said something, and you could tell that he was clearly holding back, but he said one thing that is super important and I think speaks so much to the culture of the New York Mets and what they do wrong. And what he said was, the game slows down. And I had someone ask me yesterday, well, what does that mean? What do you mean the game slows down when you're in Tampa? It has nothing to do with traffic. It has nothing. The reality is, and I think people, not you, are missing this, is that when you're a catcher, you're the quarterback. You're at least you're one half of what comprises the quarterback. You're studying video of opposing hitters. You're calling a game. You're framing pitches. You have to work on throwing. You're throwing, and d'Arnaud was rightfully criticized a lot of the time for how he threw, but he had Tommy John surgery. He missed the year, and you're working on hitting. And for d'Arnaud, in an organization like the New York Mets, where you understand that the owner is or the owner's son is going to be managing or micromanaging every single plate appearance, every single game, to come back and have a 23-game sample size or 23 plate appearance sample size, and then to understand that if you make one bad pitch call, then you might be sitting for the next 3 days, and they don't allow you to get into a routine, and you get rushed up from the minor leagues after missing a year. Why do you think people have success after they go everywhere else? And why would anyone want to compete for a place that doesn't give their players the best opportunity to succeed?
I think your question is answered twofold. I think your question is answered with d'Arnaud in particular, and with the general question of why players go and have success elsewhere. We'll get to that later. With d'Arnaud, the Post article that wrote about him and his transition to Tampa, he said you could clearly see that there was things he wanted to say but couldn't. He said the quote that resonates with me was, "It's different over there." And if that's not code for something, I don't know what is. Now, and d'Arnaud, and you know how I felt about d'Arnaud, and how I felt more about the fans that always pumped him up to this Hall of Fame level when he wasn't there. It's more that than d'Arnaud personally. Okay. Now, and seriously, I think that kind of clouds my judgment about a player the expectations were very high for Darnold, and the leeway that he got from a certain portion of the fan base was just unbelievably long. Okay. But I'll say this, Travis Darnold is the microcosm of how the Mets can screw up a free lunch. Okay. And the Mets had two choices when it came to Darnold at the beginning of this year. Number one was non-tender him and save the $4 million on salary. And yes, we do have to worry about that when it comes to the Mets. We have to worry about the nickels and the dimes. It's unfortunate. The second choice was to ride him out and hope that he recovers from TJ surgery, which is a very astute point that he's coming off of it, that he was coming off of injury. And ride him out and then hope that he can have value as a backup catcher, and you keep him as depth for when Ramos gets hurt and if Nito couldn't handle the major league game, which Nito has. But you had two options. The Mets, of course, chose what was behind door number three, which was to give Darnold 18 plate appearances and then lose them completely, ensuring that they would pay him to perform for somebody else, which is hysterical because they don't want to do that with managers. They'll never fire Mickey Callaway in season because they don't want to pay a manager not to manage. But they've got no problem paying Darnold to be employed somewhere else because they make a decision like that. And Darnold's lighting it up with Tampa. He had a walk-off home run the other day. And not to say that I or anybody else saw this coming, because I didn't. But you look at what's happened now, that he's in a very low-pressure situation. And yeah, some people can't handle New York. That's the mythological statement. But in truth, some people can't handle playing for that organization, because there's another team that plays in New York that seems to do just fine with the much higher expectations that they have. And yet they've got guys like Gio Urshela who are performing at all-star levels over there. Would Gio Urshela have that kind of season playing in the Mets organization? No. And people might say that, oh, well, that's coincidence. That's all in the player themselves. They can't handle New York. Is it? We have a big enough sample size for a lot of guys that have come to the Mets and haven't performed. Is it? The other damning thing is that, yes, you've had people that have gone somewhere else and performed. You look at Jay Bruce, who, you know, Jay Bruce is a professional. Jay Bruce is going to do his best everywhere he goes. But look at what he did in Seattle. Never mind what he's doing in that ballpark in Philly. Look at what he's doing in Seattle. Look at what Swarzak's doing with Atlanta. But also just as damning is the players that they've given up that have gone on to do nothing that nobody would touch, because the Mets are the only team to give players, those kind of players, a chance. So you think of all the players and the managers who haven't gone on to other jobs post-Mets. I think that's just as damning as the players that have gone elsewhere and succeeded. But again, it is a pattern that I think, and maybe there's nothing to it. People might be right when they say there's nothing to that. It's a myth. Okay, fine. But I guess what I'm asking is, why can't the Mets ever be introspective enough to see what they have and see what's going on and see if there is a problem in terms of development, in terms of the way they handle things, in terms of the micromanaging? You know, Brody is turning out to be a micromanager. Brody's turning out to be a guy, he's a George Steinbrenner wannabe. He's a Jerry Maguire wannabe. Throwing chairs in meetings with coaches to blame them for what's going on with your acquisition? I mean, come on. And again, I'll be fair with that as well, because that came after a botched video replay where Todd Frazier was maybe safe, maybe out, that they challenged that rather than not have a challenge for the obvious call when Rhys Hoskins was clearly out at the plate. Maybe that's why Brody was upset with that chair throwing incident, but that hasn't come out, and that's speculation. The fact of the matter is, you're 6 months into this job. You're 6 months into having that experience of being a general manager, and you're all of a sudden going to act like you've been there 20 years. Don't compare this to Billy Bean, who, when he was supposedly throwing chairs that was depicted in the Moneyball movie, he had, he had 15 years of apprenticeship and job experience going into it. Brody's got 6 months at this. Pipe down with the chair throwing.
And he was also alone. Billy Bean was also alone in a room. It wasn't like he was with other folks.
Well, there are some scenes in the movie where he was throwing chairs with other folks. But again, it's Hollywood. They could have Hollywoodized that to the hilt. You know, this isn't Hollywoodized. If they make a movie out of Brody Van Wagenen's tenure with the Mets so far, it's going to be a snuff film. Okay? Seriously. But, and I realize I've gone on a lot of tangents, but I think that's the big key with the Mets is why don't they ever get introspective and really see and ask themselves hard questions about what is wrong with this organization and what is right with this organization? Because they can't get that right either. They didn't scout Pete Alonso well enough to have him come up to the majors last year. They didn't scout Jeff McNeil well enough to just plug him in as the starting second baseman this year. They almost traded him to Seattle in the Diaz deal. So, and that's a major, major problem, is that the Mets are never honest with themselves, good or bad. And again, and I'm going to harp on this too, when you combine that with the experience that fans have in the ballpark, the fans that are up in the bleachers, when you combine that, that's where the apathy comes from. And the other problem is that the Wilpons ownership they don't have the incentive to work on the game day experience for the fans that sit in the outer reaches of the ballpark, because 80% of a ball club's revenue from ticket sales come from the expensive seats and it comes from the suites. We're the 20%ers. There's no reason to reach out and help us to make sure that all the concession stands are staffed for a Friday or Saturday game when it's crowded. And they haven't been this year. So, and I think when you combine all of that, it's more and more fans are throwing up their hands and saying, well, what the hell can I do? There's nothing I can do to change this.
Also, not to get so microcosm here, but I was at a game in April and I was a little chilly and I wanted to get I admittedly had like just a long sleeve t-shirt or a t-shirt or something on.
It's hard to dress for Citi Field. I'll say that. So
it is. There's all the wind and everything like that. And I went to the team store and the cheapest hoodie or long sleeve t-shirt or something was like $80. I looked for like any other layer, and I don't think you can buy anything that's like under $45 in general. Everything is super expensive and inaccessible. But that's probably Major League Baseball and more in general.
Well, yeah, it could be. It probably is Major League Baseball in general. But again, it's something like that that adds to it. When you, there are certain things that are Mets problems, and there are certain things that are baseball problems. The length of game is a baseball problem. I think that's why people enjoyed the Home Run Derby so much on Monday, because you packed all that quote unquote action. And yeah, I mean, look, it's batting practice, but it's fun. It's a fun little thing, which is why I don't get why people are all complaining about format and this and that. Listen, calm down. Everybody was great in it. Alonso and Guerrero were wonderful in that. And, you know, it was a great event, but it was packed into basically 2.5 hours, 2 hours and 45 minutes. And it was nonstop. You talk about a baseball game, you look at the All-Star game, which when by the time you hear this, it'll be last night. I bet you the All-Star game will be no less than 3 hours and 30 minutes, no less than 3:30 with all of these changes. And by the end of the game, it's going to be close to 11:30 or midnight, and all of the starters that were voted in by the fans are going to be gone from the game, replaced anyway. So that's a baseball problem. And that's something – all the things that I've talked about with the in-game experience. If baseball wants to do something about declining attendance, if they want to do something about creating more fans for the future, here's my suggestion. Don't worry about London. Don't worry about China. Don't worry so much about growing the game globally. Do the things that you're supposed to do. Do the things that you're already doing and do them better. Make the game day experience better for fans. And that's not, you know, and there's a lot of lazy thinking when it comes to that. Oh, well, we need to cater to the millennials, so we're going to have lots of loud music with pulsing beats, and we're going to have everybody just clapping their hands, and it's going to be nonstop, and it's manic. It doesn't work, okay? And Citi Field's probably the biggest perpetrator of this, okay? Sunday, Mets are down 4-0. Robinson Cano's up with two outs and nobody on, and there's an 0-1 count to him. And I'm watching this on TV, and all of a sudden they gotta come up with everybody clap your hands. Clap, 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 clap. And then everybody starts clapping because they hear the music, but then when the music dies down, they stop clapping. Aren't you supposed to clap to get the players involved? But here's the thing. If it's a big moment in a game, people will clap and start cheering and do that organically. And yeah, maybe in big moments you could do that. But do I need to hear everybody clap your hands in the first inning down 0-4 when I'm in the stands trying to have a conversation with somebody? It's every pitch, and it's becoming Pavlov's dog in Citi Field. And that's another thing. I don't mean to come off as old guy and let's just have organ music for 9 innings. No, I'm not saying that at all. What I'm saying is it's lazy thinking to just say, oh, well, music equals excitement. Well, then go to a club, okay? I was watching let me give you an example. I was watching an episode of Brockmire, okay? Of all things, I'm going to invoke here a Brockmire episode. All right, Brockmire is it's three. I highly recommend it, by the way. Three seasons of Brockmire on IFC, Independent Film Channel. I think that's what it stands for. And Hank Azaria, yep, who you know from The Simpsons, is an old timey baseball announcer who, at the beginning of season one, gets fired, and he goes on drug trips and benders and all of these different jobs. And basically in search of his soul. And it's freaking hilarious, okay? I recommend it, Josh, I recommend it highly to you. I think you'd enjoy it. I think you'd love it. It's on the raunchy side, but I recommend it highly to anybody who hasn't seen it. Now, I say that there's a specific episode in the last season where Amanda Peet's character, who's been one of the constants all three seasons, she's looking to get a marketing job with the Tampa Bay franchise. And she guaranteed that she'd have a spring training game for the Tampa Bay franchise filled up. All the seats would be filled. She'd guarantee it. And they're like, okay, all right, we'll see what you can do. And this is when the whole Pokemon thing was going on you pick up your phone and you're looking around for all these characters that are random in the streets. So what Pokemon Go. So what she did in this show was she made it so that if the pitcher on the mound strikes out a batter to end the inning, you will get a super rare Pokemon Go character. They didn't call it Pokemon in the show, but you will get a super rare character downloaded to your phone. And I thought it was funny. It played on the whole Pokemon thing. I've actually been thinking about that lately. And I'm thinking, you know what? And the way she explained it in the show was, You know, because the owners were like, well, what are you doing? These fans are never going to come back. Okay, you got them here once, but they're not paying attention to the game. And what she said was, well, listen, if he strikes out this batter and they all get this Pokemon character, you know what's going to happen? They're going to associate this Pokemon character with that pitcher who got that strikeout. In turn, they're going to learn more about this pitcher. In turn, they're going to learn more about the game. Now you're hooked. Okay. All right. So, and then I thought from there, it's like, oh, okay, well, yeah. This must be why Justin Turner used Call Me Maybe as his walk-up music when he was a Met in 2011 and 2012. Because, oh, the fans love Call Me Maybe. And that, trust me, that made me sick hearing that whenever Turner was up. Nah, it made me sick. But I get it.
Oh, come
because
on.
Because now all the people that love that, so all the kids in the stands that would sing along every time Call Me Maybe came on, they're now Justin Turner fans because he loved that, because he used that song. And now you have created a bond between those fans and Justin Turner, okay? And I say that all in theory. But this is where if you're going to use loud pulsating music, right, if you're going to do things like that, attach it to the action on the field. If you can do things like, you know, more along the lines of walk-up music that attaches to the game on the field, then it works. Just to indiscriminately play everybody clap your hands every inning, it does nothing to the game day experience. And it's lazy. It's lazy thinking. Come up with something better. Come up with something that'll create a bond between the fan and the athlete in the game day experience. They do a lot of it. There's a lot of bonds created on social media. It needs to be done for the game day experience instead of just being lazy and playing this loud music for 9 innings. It just wears you out. It wears you out.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, it's frightening.
And you're young and you're telling me they play too much loud music at a ball game.
It's frightening. I think I'm going to – look, Mr. Met is terrifying. I don't like him. I think he's really creepy. They do this weird thing on the scoreboard or whatever, the Jumbotron, where they like multiply him 100 times with his head and it looks like a schizophrenic nightmare.
Yeah, that's scary.
And I'm looking at this thing and there's music blasting and I'm thinking if there were a few lasers here, it would be like we were in a dystopian cyberpunk movie from the early 90s. This is,
or at the very worst, it would cause somebody to have a seizure.
Yeah, it's also like, what is this? What are we rooting for? All right, and then this is another critique of the team. Why should I care about Mr. Met? He just comes on the field and shoots T-shirts. He has no personality. The Fanatic gets it right. Dinger gets it right.
No, I gotta disagree with you. Dinger's scary. Dinger, Dinger is. Listen, I get why Kevin Burkhardt tweeted that he wanted to punch Dinger in the face. Dinger is creepy. If you ever watch a Rockies game in the bottom of the ninth inning or the top of the ninth inning, when Wade Davis or whoever is going for the save, and Dinger is just kind of like standing there, like with his creepy little eyes behind home plate, just waiting to burst on the field. That, if you're a kid watching that game, you're scared. You're having nightmares about Dinger.
Or if you're a Rockies fan, you love him.
Man, I'd like to know that. I want to know how many Rockies fans actually love Dinger. I'd love to do like some research on this. My brother's into research. I should have him do that. I'll pay him because he does a lot of consulting work and a lot of freelance stuff. I'll pay him to go to Denver and do research on which Rockies fan, what percentage of Rockies fans actually love Dinger. I want to know this.
Better yet, I'll be in Denver at the Colorado Rockies versus Miami Marlins on August 17th, and I'll go ask around.
God bless you. God bless you. See, but okay, that's what, dear New York Mets, this is the fan here. Josh is the guy you want to make happy. Because he's going to go to baseball games. He's going to Denver to do it. And I want to know, now let me ask you, is this a weekend game you're going to?
It's a Sunday afternoon game.
Okay, Sunday afternoon, so the crowd's going to be up, probably going to be a giveaway. I want, when you get back, I want your honest opinion. We'll do a podcast about it.
Yeah.
Comparing the game day experience at a Rockies game to the game day experience at Citi Field. I want to know if what we're discussing with the in-game happenings at a ball game, does this happen everywhere? Is going to a Rockies game as exhausting as going to a Mets game? I want to know. And maybe you'll be slightly biased towards the Rockies because this is sort of like a vacation for you, or a getaway. If this is a work trip for you, a getaway. So, but I want to know honestly the difference between ballpark experiences.
Well, I could tell you right off the bat, to sit right behind home plate, 30 rows up, you know, forget it, not even 30 rows. Let's go 9 rows up. Yeah, that's the closest I can even look at right now. It's a $65 ticket to sit 9 rows behind the dugout.
That's not bad. I've seen similar prices for like Brewers games on StubHub where you could sit right behind the plate, right by front row Amy for $65.
Yeah, so that's just to start. And it's a simpler layout somehow. It's less confusing. I'll let you know if there's a giveaway or anything, but it's you know, I'm looking more forward to that. It's just for a trip. I'm going out to Colorado to visit some of my cousins and to go hiking and kayaking and escape to nature a little bit.
Okay, so you'll have other fun experiences there. So, okay. So yeah. That'll be fair.
Right. But you touched on something super important. And that is the fact that it's not necessarily fun to go to Citi Field anymore. It's a chore. And I think that you said something in your outline, but I'm not sure if you've mentioned it yet today. And that is the fact that the Mets organization has contempt for its fans. And you saw it when Citi Field opened. They had a rotunda for Jackie Robinson, which is beautiful and not taking away from that. But there was almost no other evidence, if you walked into this stadium, that it wasn't a museum for the Brooklyn Dodgers instead of a place for the New York Mets. They later on added the Hall of Fame. They later on added all of these photos.
And they were shamed into it.
Right, right. And so when you look at it, I ask, what are the things that they're doing in Queens to engender trust and build rapport with the community and make people care about this organization on a long-term basis? Because as we're seeing the New York Mets, you know, kind of suffer through this apathy that you're talking about, you're conversely seeing a resurgence elsewhere, but not in the major leagues. No, the minor leagues recorded a near record attendance of about 40.5 million fans last year. 15, of those 40.5 million fans that attended minor league games, 20 teams set all-time attendance records. And I think that's staggering. I mean, you have teams like the AAA Charlotte Knights, whose average attendance was almost 9,000. You have the Fresno Rough Riders, led AA. You had a whole bunch of teams that were drawing almost 5 figures a game. And to that I say, well, they're doing all these brilliant things and call them hokey if you will, but they're taking the measures to rebrand themselves with fun names and become part of the community. Is that something that's lacking with the Mets?
Well, I don't know if you're going to see major league teams – excuse me. I don't think you're going to see major league teams all of a sudden call themselves like the Chihuahuas or the Cheesesteaks or anything like that. I think that is a factor. But I do think that aside from minor league gimmicks, which are great, I think with the Mets in particular, what they lack in doing that other teams do is the winter caravans. I think once the Mets stopped doing the winter caravans, where they had the players go to different spots in the city and interact with the fans, I think that really hurt the Mets. And I think that's a huge factor in not connecting with the community. That's why when you see all of these things, all of these polls, when you talk about what zip codes in New York skew more Yankee or more Met, that every single zip code, including 11368, which is Citi Field, every single one has more Yankee fans than Met fans when it comes to ticket sales and social media and everything like that. And I think that's why you're seeing it. I think now, listen, and that's not to take anything away from what the fans do with the Queens Baseball Convention, which is kind of what was an outreach of a residue of the Mets not having a winter caravan. Why is it that the fans have to, again, the Mets have such contempt for their fans that they're forcing them to create these events? Why do the fans have to create these events? Why isn't the team doing this? Because you're not going to get new fans this way. The Queens Baseball Convention, if you're going to the Queens Baseball Convention, chances are you've been a fan for life, and that's not going to change. And there's nothing wrong with that. I'm not knocking it, to be sure. I'm not knocking the event. But these are things that the Mets should be doing. Pete Alonso, Jeff McNeil, Michael Conforto, Noah Syndergaard, Steven Matz, they should be touring this city nonstop before spring training. From January 15th to February 15th, they should be in Long Island. They should be in Staten Island. They should be in Rockland County. They should be all over the New York baseball area. All over that. They should be in New Rochelle. This is what they did in the 60s. And this is why the Mets were, when they first existed, were known as the team of the people. Because every year they went out and had these caravans. And they were doing it in the Willie Randolph era too. They were doing it before, up until 2006, 2007. They were doing that. Why are the Mets not doing that? If they want to connect with fans, because listen, the team isn't going to always be good. But if you can find a way to connect with your fans and create new fans, then you're going to have that turnover in fans coming back. Fans will always love you if you connect, if you find a way to connect with them. You're not going to do it with 80% discounts because Pete Alonso won the home run derby. Boring. You're not going to do it that way. There's just the Mets get so lazy with that too. And that's another reason why, that's another thing that the Mets should be introspective about, and about how they're connecting with their current fans and how they make new fans.
Right. And even if the Mets are giving 80% off of a $20 ticket, I'm still paying gas or train, $25 to park, and $15 to $20 in food. I'm still shelling out $50 to $60 for the day.
Mm-hmm.
Let me in for free. I mean, the reality is, I still wouldn't go. And that's damning. I wouldn't
That's telling. And that's what you're who the Mets should be listening to. Okay, seriously.
There's no but. At this point in the season, at this point in my life, call me a baseball hater. Call me whatever you want. It doesn't affect me. I know that I love baseball. I would have to be, I don't plan after that Thursday, July 3rd game to go to a New York Mets game again unless a friend decides to have a birthday there. Or unless it's so important to someone else that it's just going to happen.
That's a problem. And people may dismiss you for this, but I guarantee you, anybody that's listening that's saying Josh is crazy, I guarantee you that if Josh feels this way, other people feel this way. He can't be the only one. I see it all the time on Twitter. I see it. I hear it. It's definitely something that's palpable more this year than any other year in history. And you might think, these guys have just spending an hour berating the Mets. Okay, they're not true fans. Well, I'm a true fan until I die. Can I say something right now? Can I go on a rant here?
Please.
When I hear I'm a true fan until I die, when I hear that, I want to throw up. Okay? And it's not because it's not because I think you're lying to me, but it's because I think that you're trying to prove something to me and you're trying to prove something to yourself. Okay. I'm a true fan until I die. I know. I could tell by your profile picture. I could tell by all your tweets. I could tell by all of your Facebook posts. I know you're a true fan until you die. What I want you to know is that Josh and I aren't sitting here for an hour berating the Mets because we hate them. Okay? If it was simply we hate this team, we wouldn't have a podcast. Okay? And I know Josh is apathetic towards them, and I know Josh is kind of moving away right now, but Josh spent many years loving this team. I've spent many more years loving this team. Loving this team does not mean you have to agree with everything that they do. And the reason we are saying the things that we're saying is because we care, and we want to see this organization become what it should be, what it can be. It's not hard. I had somebody, a very good friend of mine, Jake Stevens, who's been on this podcast before, and he mentioned to me, well, you know, excuse me, how many great teams are there? How many great organizations are there? 5, 6? And that might be true. It might be true that a lot of organizations have their own problems, and a lot of organizations have problems that are built in that they can't do anything about, like Tampa and Oakland and Cincinnati and teams like that. And maybe there are things that they can do. Maybe there are things that they're doing wrong. Everybody's got their problems. We understand that. But a team in the New York market should be able to use the might that they have and the smarts that they used to have to engender a relationship, to build a relationship with their fans that is everlasting. The Mets have been bad for a long time with accidents of goodness, okay? It never affected the fan base the way it's starting to affect them now. That is a problem. Even if you're bad every year, even if Brody is making awful decisions with the roster, there's still a way that you can connect with your fans that will be everlasting. And I'm going to tell you right now, writing articles about why we should embrace Chase Utley is not going to do it. It's not. That's not the way you build relations with your fans.
It's clickbait, though. It works.
It's not hard. Yeah, I know. I know it's clickbait. And I call him Page Click Tino. Okay. But the greater point being is that you would never read another writer for say that Todd Zielecki would never write an article on NBCSportsPhiladelphia.com saying, oh, it's time for Philly fans to forgive Jose Reyes. No, he wouldn't do it. You'd never see somebody on the Angels broadcast carrier website saying it's time to forgive Randy Johnson for shoving it up our butts in 1995. No, it would never happen with any other fan base, but it happens here. And that's what seems so over the top. It's things like that that are exhausting. And I'm not one for homerism either. You know, I'm not one for everything being flowery and, you know, let's only focus on the positive and what. No, it doesn't work that way. But the Utley article was a bit much, okay? And you combine that with everything else that this team has gone through, that this team does to us on the field, in the stands, it becomes exhausting. And we don't complain because we hate them. We don't complain because we don't care. But people are starting to not care. And that is a problem.
Yeah. I mean, there's nothing to keep you there. And by the way, you were mentioning that discussion you had about what constitutes a great organization. I would say that both the Tampa Bay Rays and the Oakland Athletics are great organizations because of what they do with their constraints. For them to be as limited as they are, since 2008, from 2008 until 2018, so for the duration of the Tampa Bay Rays, when they moved from the Devil Rays to the Rays, and not including this season because it's not over, they've averaged 90 wins per season. The Oakland A's, meanwhile, for over their last 10 seasons, from 2009 through 2018, they've averaged 82 wins per season, and they have made the playoffs on four separate occasions. I'd say with those constraints, that's what constitutes a great organization. Constantly overcoming the odds through strategic planning and knowing when to shoot your shot and knowing when it's not going to be your year and optimizing for a specific situation rather than failing to understand or contextualize what's happening and trying in spite to create some kind of dumb luck or magic.
They get teams like Tampa and Oakland get the most out of their roster and their resources every year, even if they don't win every year. Even I felt, and I watch from afar. I do pay attention to other teams, and I pay attention to the Rays a good amount, which is weird because it's the Rays, but still, it always marvels me to watch them where they can win 74 games in a season and it feels like a success. Because they get the most out of their roster and resources every single year. Now, somebody who watches the team more closely might tell me that's not true, but from afar, that's how it seems to me. They get the most out of the resources that they have. And even the Yankees. I mean, listen, I can't remember the last time the Yankees had a season under 500. It might be the early 90s. You know why? Because they get the most out of their resources, and they have a lot of resources. And I know you might be saying that's a bad example to use, but they get the most out of their resources. They get the most bang for their buck every year on the field. Now, they've got a lot of tickets in that ballpark that none of us can afford, and that's fine. But people buy them, and they make revenue, but they spend money to make money. They understand that even when they do dopey things like have Yankees cologne – which is really the dumbest thing that I've ever heard, and the Yankees should be ashamed of themselves for that. Ashamed. But they put the resources back into the team, even if they fail. Like Giancarlo Stanton, the jury's still out on whether Giancarlo Stanton was a good move or not. But they shot their shot, as you say. Whatever they do on the side – they have the number one priority is making the product on the field as good as it can be. Now, just stop with the Yankees cologne for crying out loud. It's dumb. It's stupid. But I think the Mets think they're doing that. I think that they think that they're doing this for the long-term health of the baseball team. But there's always an underlying, we can market Robinson Cano.
Yeah.
There's always that underlying, and that's what, we can market Todd Frazier because he's played in this market. And it's going to be the same thing if they hire Joe Girardi next year. Oh, Girardi won a championship with the Yankees. We could create excitement among the fan base with a Joe Girardi hire. And I think if Joe Girardi wasn't nearly as good as he actually is, the Mets would still think that way. But again, if they hire Joe Girardi next year, they'll do it for the wrong reasons, but they'll get lucky and win because Joe Girardi's fantastic. Joe Girardi gets the most out of his team. You look at the Pythagorean win-losses records of some of those Yankee teams that he managed, and there's no way that they should have won any of that. There's no way that some of the teams that he managed should have even been close to the playoffs. But he got them there because he's one of the few managers, him and Joe Maddon, and some of the others in the past, and Mike Socha, who just retired, they're some of the few managers that win games for their team rather than lose games for their team.
Right, right. But the thing with Girardi is I'm not convinced he comes in and changes anything. I think that's the issue. I think, to put a cherry on top of this discussion, that the idea that this is any one person, any one fix – any one above average person in a mediocre or terrible situation can come in and change it is more of the same. For as accomplished an executive, and he had faults, but for as accomplished an executive of Sandy Alderson was, you go back to that 2010 interview with the New Yorker that the Wilpons did, and they're snake bitten. But what they're failing to realize is that it rots from the head, and that you can insert Girardi here, and you can insert Jim Leland, you can insert Earl Weaver, you could insert Barry Bonds in his prime, and he'll accidentally shoot a steroid on the wrong ass cheek and bust a vein. Like, I'm convinced that it's not actually any one person, and that changing Girardi and Callaway next year, sure, maybe the Mets are 45 wins at the All-Star break. Maybe they're 45-45. But it doesn't change the fact that of the last 11 years, over the last 1,200 ball games, 13, 1,400, 1,500 ball games that they've played, that the only year and a half run, because for half of 2017, they sure as hell, or 2016, they sure as hell were not good. It was a mistake. It was plan B. Even the most accomplished executive, Sandy Alderson, could not come in and execute a plan A that was going to work. It's plan B, or it's a mistake when they're successful, and it's right on course when they're correct. And like you said, as long as they're in that marketing snake oil salesman mentality, this Ouroboros is going to continue to eat its own tail, and you can close your eyes in a decade, and I guarantee you, so long as the Wilpons are the owners of this organization, and so long as they don't continue to stumble into dumb luck, which works, you'll get a good season out of it every 10 years just by virtue of mistake, but you'll look and you'll see that there's going to be seasons where they win between 68 and 79 wins. And then you'll have two or three years where they'll be plus 500. And of those two or three, one of them might be a quote unquote magical playoff run. And then they'll rest on their laurels and market around that same team for the next few years, hoping to strike magic twice. But you can't strike magic twice when you don't know how the trick is performed. And that's my feeling toward the New York Mets.
It's something called the Carbonaro effect. It's a hidden camera magic TV show that you're on right now. Listen, you're absolutely right. You are 1,000% right. And I think people that if you don't realize that by now, you will realize it. And I can't think of a better way to end this part of the discussion. And if you've stuck with us this long and you've heard all of this, then I want you to find us on Twitter and respond to us and tell us your honest feelings about what we've said today, what we've said so far. If you agree with us that the game day experience has taken a hit, if you don't agree with us, we want to hear from you at Metstradamus, at Josh Chapdelaine. We will have this on Twitter, and we want to create a discussion here with this. But if you've stuck with us this long, thank you. We're gonna put a wrap on it. We're gonna talk about other things because we don't want to be miserable all podcast. But know that our misery comes from love. I love the Mets, and I think Josh deep down still loves the Mets. But I think he just needs a break from them right now. And I think he needs a break from them. I think he needs a break from this ownership, and I think we all do. But listen, whatever baseball you're enjoying, we hope you continue to enjoy it. And like I said, if you don't agree with us, let us know. We want to discuss this with you. Can you talk about the second half?
I would love to.
Of the season?
I would love to.
Okay, so I got some questions I want to hear your thoughts on about what's going to happen the second half of the season. I hope you have some for me. I want to talk about the Dodgers for a little bit because right now they have the best record in the league by three wins. They have 60 wins at the All-Star break, which is phenomenal. It seems like they're continuing on this path where they're going to get knocked down and then finally get to that pinnacle this year. Now, Chase Utley's not on the roster, so they can win the World Series this year. I don't care. But I'm going to ask you I'm gonna give you a buy or sell, yay or nay. You know, we can't really use some of them for, you know, because other TV shows have done that first. But I ask you this question: for your World Series winner, do you take the Dodgers or do you take the field?
I take the field. I can't see the Dodgers winning the World Series. I don't think they're cursed. I don't think they're hexed. I don't believe in anything like that with that organization. I just think that it's incredibly difficult for the most dominant or best baseball team over the course of 162. I know that we're coming off of a year where the Red Sox did manage to do it. I think it's very difficult for that to happen twice. I think that the Yankees were very successful in doing that in the 90s. I think the Red Sox were masterful in doing it last year. But I think a lot will rest on how the rotation holds up in the second half of the season. You do have some questions. Can Rue really sustain a sub-2 ERA? Can Jensen continue to be as dominant as he's been? And can the bullpen hold up? I think that you had a tremendous amount of success in the first half, but I think that the other teams in the division will get better. I think that you're looking at a Rockies team and a Padres team that will definitely want to make trade deadline acquisitions rather than sell. I think that the division does tighten up a little bit, but ultimately I have a hard time right now betting against the Houston Astros over in the American League. And I think that they will prove to be too much for the Los Angeles Dodgers this year.
I'm going to take the field as well. And I'm going to throw a monkey wrench into everything you said.
Okay.
Not really a monkey wrench, but I'm going to take it one step further. I don't think the Dodgers are going to make the World Series.
Right. That too.
Yeah. And I don't think it's because they're a bad team. I think they're a tremendous team. I think that lineup is incredibly difficult to pitch to. I think their pitching is the real deal. I think Walker Buehler still might be the best pitcher on that staff. Mm-hmm. Better than Kershaw, better than Ryu. Walker Buehler's the guy I fear in the playoffs. But I don't think they're going to make the World Series because, and maybe it's because I've watched a lot of their games, I think the Atlanta Braves are going to beat them in a 7-game series.
Really?
And I think it goes along with what you said about anything being able to happen in a 7-game series, about, you know, luck carrying the day in the playoffs. And what you said about the Rockies and Padres making acquisitions, I still think the Braves are going to make acquisitions because they've got room in their payroll. I think they're going to go get a starting pitcher. I think you could see them getting a Zach Wheeler, perhaps, or maybe a Madison Bumgarner if his latest injury isn't too much for him. I think they're going to go get a starting pitcher. I think they may even get some bullpen help. I think Will Smith is out there for them. And I think once they shore it up, you saw how competitive they were even in a 4-game series loss to the Dodgers last year. And the way this team is hitting this year, I think that the Braves can beat the Dodgers in a 7-game series and make the World Series.
Hard to argue. I mean,
no, it's easy to argue, but it's just the feeling I get watching a lot of Braves games this year and watching a lot of Dodgers games. Also, I think that's going to be the best playoff series of the bunch.
I think I do too. I think a lot will rest on whether or not the Dodgers can maintain home field advantage throughout the playoffs. And right now they certainly do have that luxury, but the Braves are only 6 games behind, 4.5 games behind, actually. And I think that's going to be the big thing, because the biggest statistic that stands out to me is that through the Dodgers' first 49 home games, they're 37-12 at home. It's hard to argue with.
Yeah. But they have lost a game 7 in a playoff series before at home, so –
For sure.
You never know. Listen, and that's the beauty of baseball. You never know.
For sure.
You never know. Speaking of you never know, I want to talk about the National League Central because it's a fascinating division. Last place in the Central is the Cincinnati Reds, but they're only 4.5 games out of first. There's no other second place team that's as close to their first place team in any other division. So I'm going to say buy or sell, yay or nay, however, whatever you want to call it. The Cincinnati Reds, before the season is over, we'll spend one day in first place in the division.
I'm going to have to say nay here. I think that it's a super tight division, but I think that the Cubs and Brewers are ultimately too good. I think the Cardinals are resilient. They've had a lot of players underplay this year, but I don't think that you can expect to keep up that level of malproduction. I think Goldschmidt should light it up in the second half of this season. He had a rough start in the beginning of 2018, but he turned it on for the second half. I think that you expect a lot out of him. I think the Pirates have performed well, but they haven't performed as well as I think they have the potential to. You could probably make the same case for the Reds and say that a lot of their pieces are improving or set to improve. But I'm going to say that the dominance of the Chicago Cubs and the Milwaukee Brewers is going to be a little bit too much for the Reds to ever really gain five games over the course of the next half of the season to take even a one-day claim for first place.
I think Cincinnati gets one day. I think that they will be in first place at some point before the season's out. Now, I don't think they're going to win the division. I think once they reach that plateau, they're gonna fall off. I say this because for three reasons. Number one, they've got a stretch coming up after the All-Star break where a lot of their games are in division. Okay, and they've got three games coming up with Chicago right off the bat. And I don't know if you realize this, but they're 6-3 against the Cubs. So that's good in their favor. The other thing, too, is that I think the Reds are that kind of team. Like you said, we all thought at the beginning of the year, and I said at the beginning of the year, that this is a team that can run off a 10-game winning streak at some point and surprise everybody, that they have that ability. They could go 12-4. They could go 15-6. I think the Reds have that run in them. And I think that they can zoom to the top of the division. They can take advantage of this interdivision schedule. And against the rest of the division, they're hovering around 500. So it's not like they've really hit the tank against teams like Milwaukee and St. Louis. I think they're one game under 500 against each of those teams. But I think they could take advantage of this interdivision schedule, go on a run, hit first place, and then I think they'll be exposed a bit and fall back a little bit. But I think there's going to be a day. Could be the end of July, could be the middle of August, where the Cincinnati Reds are going to surprise us all behind the arm of Sonny Gray if they don't trade him. and reach first place for one day.
Which would be a huge accomplishment in and of itself.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. But I don't think they'll win a division. I don't think they'll be near the playoffs. But I think they're going to surprise us. Now, the last question I have for you, and I noticed that with the Washington Nationals have gone on the same type of run that I'm predicting for the Reds, and they're actually in wild card position right now. And their opponent would be the Philadelphia Phillies, which would be incredible, which would actually make me want to travel to see that game. Bryce Harper against his old team in a one-game knockout playoff series, that would be incredible. So I will ask you this. Do you have the National League wildcard matchup being the Phillies and the Nationals, or do you have some other combination?
No, I have some other combination. Unfortunately, I'm going to stick to my early my preseason prediction here. I know that you're high on the Braves. What I'm going to say is that the Nationals are still the NL East champions. I think that they're playing to the level that was not only expected, but should have been expected. I still think they're the best team in the division far and away. I think that the Braves have a very potent offense. I think that you're going to see the Nationals do very well against them moving forward. I think that they're only six games behind with a half season to play, and Nationals are 8-2 in their last 10. But I do think the Braves end up in the playoffs. I think it's the Braves in the wild card. I think it's the Braves and the Chicago Cubs in the NL wild card.
I could see that happen. I'm going to go the other way, actually, because not the other way, because I actually agree with you. I don't think it's going to be Phillies Nationals in the wild card game, because that would be too good. That would be too good a scenario, because I'm hoping to go to that game. That's why it won't happen. But I'm going to go the other way in terms of, you think the Nationals are going to zoom ahead and win the division. I don't think that that's going to happen. I'm going to go back to something earlier that you said about teams like the Rockies and the Padres making deadline acquisitions. I think a team like San Diego could make one deadline acquisition, create a feeling among the roster that, hey, they're giving us a chance to go for it. And I think that they're going to zoom from there. And I think they're going to battle for the wild card. And I think somehow they're going to find a way in that game. I think they'll lose the game, but I think somehow the Padres are going to find a way to get hot with all of that talent that they have and find it in the right place and sustain it. Not like I've got Cincinnati winning 10 straight and then falling apart. I've got San Diego actually finding a way to sneak into that wild card. And again, it's because I want to see the Phillies and the Nationals play in that game that it won't happen.
Right, right. And I wanted to agree with you. I wanted to say the Padres, but in a weird little subtle hint here, I didn't want to come across as a homer at this point. And, and so I think that you're spot on, though, and they're going to be set up to win for the next maybe 6 to 8 years. So I think that there's a very strong case for that. They need essentially one or two more pieces. And I think something as simple as like what the Mets did in 15 without the Cespedes trade. But if they did something like acquiring like the equivalent of a Johnson and Uribe and then a relief pitcher like an Addison Reed, I think those are all really
cool. Not them specifically, but players like them.
Exactly. Exactly.
Kelly wants to come out of retirement, forced retirement, and play for San Diego and be their good luck charm for a half a season.
Right. Oh, wow. You said forced retirement. Did Devin Mesoraco ever come out of retirement, or is he just done?
I think that Devin Mesoraco is in that glass case where they put General Zod in at the beginning of Superman 2. That's where I think Devin Mesoraco is. He's floating around space hoping for a nuclear accident to free him from his glass prison. That's what I think has happened to Devin Mesoraco.
Poor, poor thing. And what of Addison Reed? He was released by the Twins.
Yeah, he might be in that same vote. It's so funny how we were arguing about Swarzak and Reed at the beginning of last season.
Yeah.
And that Addison Reed might have been the better get than Swarzak. And for all the problems that Swarzak had last year, he's performing well now. And Reed, I'm not sure, has a job.
Reed doesn't have a job, but for all of his for all of the negatives, I guess you could say, he was still above average relief pitcher. He was above replacement level, rather. So
we hope everybody has a job. We hope that Addison Reed and Devin Mesoraco can find work that doesn't involve selling real estate. We hope to have them back in our game. Do you have any question? Have you prepared any questions for me?
I just have general questions for you.
All right, that's good.
So I think there's two or three here. So the first question I have for you is, would you prefer the Mets win 65 games or would you prefer them win 84?
That's a great question, and I don't know how to answer that. I mean, I certainly don't think they're going to win 65 because they're not going to – the Mets are never going to tear down to the point where they're going to restock everything and aspire to greatness. I think the Mets aspire to 500. I think the Mets aspire to do just enough to get you in the ballpark and get your money. And, you know, that's part of the problem that I think we've – discussed in the first hour or so of this podcast. So I don't think that that's ever going to happen. And it's a shame because you have pieces that you could build around. And I include DeGrom and Syndergaard in that discussion with Alonso and McNeil and even Conforto and Nimmo and players like that that you can build around. But I don't know if I don't think they'll ever do that. I mean, you're going to see them at the deadline dealing Wheeler, and they're going to deal Frazier, and they might deal Vargas, and you'll get okay pieces for them, but you're not going to get great pieces because the Mets would never pick up their salaries. So I don't know. But I don't know if I want to see them win 84 either, because then it gives them a false sense of, well, hey, we're on the right track to begin with. And, you know, that's what Ronnie Darling always called a dead cat bounce. You know, they're dead in the water and then they go on this incredible run. They kind of did it last year where in August and September, they were good, and you know they were playing opponents that were battling for the title, for titles, for playoffs. So it seemed legit, but now I don't know. I don't know if they somehow win, even if they somehow even get to 500, are we going to believe it again this year? Are we going to say, oh, well, look at what they did when they were out of it? Oh, this is the team to watch. And that, I think, is part of the Ouroboros cycle that we always fall for. So I kind of want to see them win 65 if I had a choice. But I don't know. It's a tough question to answer.
Yeah. Yeah, it's definitely tricky. I'm with you. I want to see them win 65. I want to see them have to really take a hard look at everything. I want to see them have to really examine everything. I want as much scrutiny and as many microscopes as on that team as possible. It's unacceptable. The next question I have is I think a little bit more complex.
Everything is complex to me because my brain doesn't work. But go ahead.
An American League team calls and says, we want Dominic Smith. Are you inclined to trade him?
It depends on what I get back. I'd have to listen. Part of the reason the Mets have been successful, more successful offensively than they have been in the past, is the insertion of Dominic Smith in the lineup. You know, we've all expected Smith to be one of those spray hitters, one of those Olerud type hitters. And finally, he's fulfilling that. He's starting to fulfill that. And he's doing it in a new position. It's really hard to be a first baseman, to have Smith's skill set defensively at first base, and then go on to play another position. It's really difficult. And Smith isn't killing the Mets in the outfield this year. He isn't great in the outfield, but he isn't killing them. So I give Smith a lot of credit. And the unfortunate part is if somebody trades for Smith as a first baseman, then that's the way that Smith is really going to blossom. So if the Mets are going to deal Smith, they've got to do so with the notion, with the assumption that he's going to go to a team, play first base for them every day, and fulfill his potential. And now that Smith has built up that value again, it's imperative for the Mets, if they decide to trade him, to not waste it. So I don't want to see Smith go for anything, for just anybody. I think if they had dealt Smith last year, that would have been the case. And for all the things that the Mets have done wrong, I give them kudos for sticking with Smith so that he could build up some sort of value in a trade. But at this point, I don't know if Smith has more value to someone else than he does to the Mets at this point. Maybe Smith stays and maybe somebody like Brandon Nimmo goes. Or pray tell, maybe even Conforto is the guy you deal, that because you can get more for Conforto in a deal than for anybody else at this point. Maybe that's the way to go. If you could get a true center fielder in a deal, then maybe I'd think about it. But I don't know if I deal Smith at this point. I'm inclined to listen if I get bowled over, but I think there's other things you can do. I think that maybe even dealing Michael Conforto could be an option here. I would listen on him. But again, I got to be bowled away either way for either player.
So my final question for you right now, and I'm sorry they're not totally major league centric, but
it's okay.
With the New York Mets, the Wilpons knock on your door. You're Brody Van Monorail right now.
I'm Brody?
You're Brody right now.
Oh, okay. Well, I need something to throw then. Okay, let me get that set up.
And there's the cat.
I've just thrown the cat, ladies and gentlemen.
So they knock on your door and say, okay, we understand this first year you were inexperienced, but we're willing to give you another chance under the condition that – Robinson Cano gets traded. How and to whom do you trade Robinson Cano for? He's owed 4 years and $100 million.
See, and that's what you're setting up is a scenario where the Mets will repeat the mistake of Jay Bruce and Anthony Swarzak. And not to say it was a mistake to trade Jay Bruce. It's easy to say that now because Bruce is playing so well. But there was such a glut of outfielders and first basemen on the roster that Jay Bruce had to be traded. So no matter if he could go and break Barry Bonds' record at this point, it doesn't change the fact that it was necessary to unload Jay Bruce in a deal to let other players blossom. But to do that, they had to take on Cano's contract. The only way now to wheel Cano on somebody else, because his value is as low as it's ever been, and there's salary attached to that. The only way you do that is to attach somebody else of value in the deal. You can't do it with Diaz because, again, his value has dropped with the season he's had. So what do? Do you attach a Brandon Nimmo or a Dominic Smith to Cano just to get rid of that contract to put McNeil at second base? I think that would be repeating a mistake. If you could trade Cano for a low-level minor leaguer and get rid of the salary and not lose any other assets in the process, which is key, then I think you do it. But I don't think the Mets can make that type of deal without including assets in the deal. And I think the Mets have done that quite enough. And I think that, again, that's a big problem with the club, is not accumulating these assets, is treating them like instead of taking on losing salary, instead of just taking on salary on its own, they'll lose salary, but they'll give you a little something extra to make it palatable for another team to take on that salary. And that's what I thought was the problem with the whole Diaz Cano trade as a philosophy, is that they took on Cano's salary, but they didn't take they gave Seattle salary relief and they gave them prospects to make this deal. You should never, ever have to do both in a deal. You want to give a team salary relief? Great. You want to trade them prospects to get better now? That's fine. You should never have to do both.
Agreed. It's really super mind-boggling. It's super confounding. There's no need for that to have happened. But I look at this team and I think that that is the biggest burden for them moving forward. 4.5 years left on that contract, over $100 million still owed. I don't know how they get out of it. I don't know what team takes it on without taking on another one of the Mets' bright young stars, but I don't know who does. I don't know where a 36-year-old declining second baseman who's not a good hitter and best profiles as a DH fits. He belongs with Kirk Nieuwenhuis and Matt Dendecker on the Long Island Ducks.
They just signed TJ Rivera too.
They did, and he had like 3 hits in his first game. And you have Matt Dendecker, you know, hitting 782 OPS. Over there, I think Kirk Nieuwenhuis is doing well. It's the 2014 Las Vegas 51s.
Yeah, and how did they do?
The 51s? I'm sure.
How did the 51s do? We're going to have to look this up. Hold on. 2014 Las Vegas 51s. Let's look that up if you're not following along. Let's see. According to this, they were 81-63, first place in the Pacific Division.
I was going to, you know, overall, I mean, those are my real questions for you. I look at this, it seems like it's a Chinese finger trap. There's no real escape, and even escaping, you're still here. And so God bless you, and God bless your resiliency blogging, and God bless everything that you've done for giving people an outlet to vent, for giving people a reprieve from the suffering that they're enduring as they try to find a light at the end of the tunnel.
You know, at the end of the day, it's baseball. And baseball's fun. And I don't want to be angry about baseball. I don't want to be angry about the Mets. And I think no matter how frustrating they could be, I think there's always a light at the end of the tunnel for us. If it's not, if we're stuck in this Chinese finger trap, as you say, you know, maybe the light at the end of the tunnel isn't winning. Maybe the light at the end of the tunnel is us just getting through it day by day and coping with it and laughing about it. Because that's we don't do that enough in this world. We don't do that enough in this society. We don't laugh enough. And, you know, you said to me last night, you said to me after the Home Run Derby, and somebody else said to me, messaged me about how everybody, you know, Pete Alonso won the Home Run Derby, and yet everybody is angry. Everybody was arguing, and everybody is about, oh, well, Vladimir Guerrero should have won the All-Star Home Run Derby. Oh, well, Pete Alonso is great, but the Mets still stink, and blah, 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 and there's no reprieve. Pete Alonso winning the Home Run Derby couldn't even provide a reprieve for Mets fans from being angry and bitter, and I can get as angry and bitter as any of them, as you heard, but at the end of the day, it's baseball. It's supposed to be fun. And that's why I get upset about the baseball, the game day experience, because even when the team is bad, a day out at the ballpark should be better than your best day at work. Your worst day at a ballpark should be better than your best day doing anything else. And when that starts to get compromised, that bothers me. It bothers me because that's not the way you build a community, a fan base, a relationship. And that the Mets seem to have no interest in doing that, that bothers me. And that's why I get so upset about
it. Yeah, that. And it's been something that has been an integral part of your life for as long as you remember?
Pretty much as long as I remember. And May 5th, 1976 was my first Met game. And it was one of my earliest memories as a human being.
Wow.
Was Tom Seaver on the mound. I'm sitting in the loge section, and he beat the Reds 5-4, and Skip Lockwood got the save. I remember Seaver, I remember Lockwood, and I remember it being a Mets-Reds game. That's pretty much all I remembered from it, and that's how I was able to go back on baseballreference.com and figure out that that was the date, May 4th, or maybe it was May 5th, that it was one of those 2 days. But so God bless Baseball Reference.
Yeah.
Okay. For putting those for putting that puzzle together. But yeah, you know, it's been, you know, the Mets and baseball have been a huge part of my life, and it's supposed to be, again, it's supposed to be fun. And for the most part, it is fun. It's fun to complain. You know, everybody says, oh, you're such a curmudgeon, all you do is complain. You know what, though? It's fun to complain. It's fun to have that cathartic experience of complaining. It builds community. You know, I just see it now more than ever falling apart. And maybe it's just the vitriol of social media that contributes to it all falling apart. I know a lot of people have much worse experiences on social media as I don't really have a bad experiences, but I see the patterns from afar. You know, I'm a Gen Xer. I just sit back and watch the world burn. Okay. But that's what I'm seeing. I'm watching the Mets world burn. And yes, it's been burning for a while, but it's burns with so much more intensity now because it's everything in one. So that's what it is. And, you know, like I said, if you've listened this far, God bless you, because we're about an hour 45 in.
Yeah.
And it flies by. For you, it might be a chore, but for us, it flies by. I hope you've enjoyed it. I hope you enjoyed this this baseball podcast experience. We are the Burger Ball Podcast. Should we have a quick discussion about hamburgers?
You have one?
I kind of do. You know, I haven't had any new ones, but somebody posted on my Facebook page something from mentalfloss.com. 25 hamburger spots you have to visit before you die.
Okay.
Okay. The one I want to focus on, because it's just so weird and delectable, and we've discussed mayonnaise on burgers before. But Matt's Place Drive-In in Butte, Montana has this burger, and I'll describe it to you here. Their most famous burger, the Nut Burger, is a beef patty topped with a spread of crushed peanuts and Miracle Whip. If you have a peanut allergy, this is not for you. But I love that this place, it's so just weird, but it's something that I'm craving. You know, I've actually had four of the burgers on this list here on this website. But this burger that makes me want to go to freaking Butte, Montana to try it. And that's why I highlight this as my burger of the month, because I want it so bad. And how do I get to Butte, Montana when I don't drive?
I think you can Uber. I think it would be a lot of money, but I think they do it.
Don't take the Uber outside of Citi Field. If you take an Uber to Butte, Montana, don't do it after a Mets game. You'll never get it.
And you don't even need Jay Bruce to give you that PSA.
No, no, no. I'm sure Jay Bruce would go to Butte, Montana if he had the wherewithal to do so. He seems like the kind of guy that likes towns like that, like sleepy towns like that. So,
talk about a guy that got better after he left the Mets. Good Lord.
I know, seriously. Well, him and Swarzak, of course. And they got better when they got to the National League East, too. It's just that it's a part of that trade that nobody saw coming. But it's just, like I said, every Sunday needs a cherry and every pile of misery needs a sprinkle of Jay Bruce.
I think, well, that's the title of the episode.
No, I think it's still contempt.
Yeah,
I think contempt is still the title of the episode. But like I said, if you have nothing else to contribute, I'm gonna say goodbye to everybody.
I think I'm good. I've had a relatively quiet month for burgers. I've had a good month for calamari and breakfast burritos. I would like to just shout out. Oh, you know what? I lied. I'm going to shout out my favorite restaurant. Okay. And then we'll leave mercifully. Not for me, but just in general. So on the Upper West Side, I think you are not too far from here. In Manhattan, there is a place called Playa Betty's. And at Playa Betty's, they're a Mexican restaurant, and they have incredible food. They have some of the best elote I've ever had there. And I'm aware that they have a whole bunch of different types of things. And I'm going to go into the category and make a reach and say that a sandwich is considered a burger, yes? But a burger is not a sandwich. Or a burger is a sandwich, but a sandwich is not a burger.
I don't know. All I know is that a hot dog is not a sandwich.
But a burger is a kind of sandwich.
You could say a burger is a sandwich because you can have a burger without the bun. And if you have a burger without the bun, then it's certainly not a sandwich, but it's still a burger.
Right. Right. But a hamburger on the bun is a type of sandwich.
Right.
Okay. So,
but you never call it a burger sandwich.
But we will now. And so
no, I won't.
I'm going to refer to it.
Sorry. I can't. That just seems wrong to me. Like, you need never say hot dog sandwich. So a hot dog is a hot dog. It's understood that you have bread on it, but it's a hot dog.
But it's not a sandwich because there's only one piece of bread and it's folded. It's more like a pita or like halal or something like that. It depends on.
I'm not going to call it a hot dog halal.
Well, anyway, there's a sandwich at Playa Betty's for dessert that I had that was given to me on my birthday for free. And I just want to shout it out because people in the area need to go try this thing, especially on a hot summer day.
And by the way, Playa Betty's is near the Beacon Theater. So if you're going to take Josh up on this, it's up near the Beacon.
Have you been there?
No, but I just looked it up and I've been to the Beacon Theater, but I haven't been to Playa Betty's.
Yeah, there's a good. I'm there like once or twice a week, Playa Betty's. So there's a really good chance you run into me. So there's something called a churro ice cream sandwich. So it's two cinnamon sugar circular churros sandwiching creamy vanilla gelato, and the consistency. My God, the ice cream is almost a perfect melt into these circular discs of churros, and it makes for this perfect combination of warm, sugary, sweet, and cold, and it creates a contrast that is rarely found in the summer in Manhattan, and I think it's the perfect dessert.
I'm listening to you, and I can just feel the diabetes working its way through my soul.
Not my body, but
my soul.
And funny you say that, they serve it with a side of insulin.
No, they don't. Now you're kidding.
No, they don't. That's fake. But
you said that so deadpan. I had to ask.
But that is a thing.
It was so dead. You got me on that one. That's very good. That's very good.
Yeah, absolutely. But this was such a blast, John. Thank you so much for hosting again.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, man. And we'll do it again. And if you've and got people, if you've listened to this point, you know, I thank you for it. We thank you for the support that we get for this. We hope to get more support. So tell your friends. If you like this episode, tell your friends. If your friends don't like it, get new friends. This is and you have no excuse not to listen to the whole thing because it's the All-Star break and there's no baseball going on. So we hope you made it through the end. So thank you if you did, and we hope we will see you again real soon. Josh, plug your life.
You can find me at Twitter, which I may or may not have for much longer. I truly believe it's a cesspool. At Josh Chapdelaine on Instagram, at Josh Chapdelaine. Not really on Facebook. You can find the work I do on another podcast over at the Team Human Show. That's teamhuman.fm. Subscribe on all major podcast platforms. That's Team Human. It's a podcast about media, civics, politics, underlying biases of technology, all that kind of fun stuff. And you can find me complaining about the Mets on messenger.com with John almost every night if you can manage to crack into my encryption.
That would be too much effort for not a lot of reward there. But are you actually on the Team Human podcast, or do you work behind the scenes?
I work behind the scenes. I run the social media accounts. I do some occasionally. I do some of the research for the show. I help with the logistics for live events and you know, all of the behind the scenes stuff.
Okay. All right. Very good. Well, they should put you on. They should put you on the air. You should play them this show. And if they don't want to, and if the people over at Teen Human don't want to put a bullet in their brain after listening to this for 2 hours, then I think that they should automatically have you on the Teen Human podcast. For me, I am at Metstradamus on Twitter. I am part of the cesspool, so I will be there for a while. And MetstradamusBlog.com on the Sports Daily website. Also I don't think it's WLIE anymore. I think it's WBAR, but it's 5:40 a.m. on your dial at 7 o'clock on Sundays. I am on Sports Talk New York Live with the Major League Baseball Report for 5 to 10 minutes each and every week, as they say, with Mark Roserman and AJ Carter, two wonderful people who I hope to have on this podcast one day. So those are the places that you can find me, and you could find this podcast on Stitcher or wherever good podcasts are created. And we hope to expand at some point. But again, we've made it here, and I'm determined to end the show before we make 2 hours. So we're going to give you the intro, the outro music. This has been the Burger Ball Podcast. We thank you from the bottom of our hearts, and we will see you once again.